From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum on this Thanksgiving Day, happy Thanksgiving, we'll spend a pre-recorded hour with Pulitzer Prize-winning Los Angeles Times reporter and columnist Michael Hiltzlick, who has written the book Colossus, Hoover Dam and the Making of the American Century. It's the story of the largest public works project in U.S. history, and when Hoover Dam was completed in 1936, it was the largest concrete structure in the world and the world's largest dam. Michael Hiltzlick gives us the story of how it got built, and the political, social, and human dimensions, including the tragic ones that went into this remarkable feat. Forum is next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this pre-recorded edition of the Forum program. We're talking this hour with longtime veteran Los Angeles reporter and columnist Michael Hiltzlick, who has written a new book, which is a very important historical book, called Colossus, Hoover Dam and the Making of the American Century. And he's been writing about business, technology, and national affairs for over 20 years as both a reporter and a columnist and as a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. Also received a Gerald Loeb Award and has written an impressive and wide-sweeping chronicle of the building of the Hoover Dam between the Depression years of 1931 and 1935. Tells the story here of the building of the largest public works project in American history, which was also the largest hydroelectric power generating station and the world's largest dam, built by a consortium of construction companies called the Big Six under a seven-state compact. Hoover Dam was literally and in reality built by some 21,000 laborers at a time when the tensions between corporate power and labor was intense and workers injured or killed on the job found little, if any, recourse, especially since in so many instances the real labor-related causes of many deaths were concealed or fraudulently misrepresented so that families would not have to be paid compensation. This pre-recorded hour of Forum, we talk with Michael Hiltzlick about Colossus, and so good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
Actually, let's clear up something initially, because when I was a kid, we used to get confused. Boulder Dam, Hoover Dam. And you actually tell the story here about how it got the name of our former President Hoover because of, the role he played when he was Secretary of the Interior in bringing so many of these states together, disparate states together. But it was the Boulder Dam.
Well, it was originally the Boulder Canyon Project, and it was called that because originally the designers thought it would go in Boulder Canyon, which is, of course, part of the Colorado River Basin. In fact, they discovered that there were too many flaws and faults in that location, and they moved it downstream by about 20 miles to Black Canyon. But the name stuck for many years. And then once Hoover became president, his Secretary of the Interior and close personal friend, a former president of Stanford named Ray Wilbur, went out in 1930 for the groundbreaking. And to everybody's surprise and without any forewarning, he said, as he pounded a silver spike into a railroad spur, he said, "By the way, I'm going to name this great structure after the great engineer who leads our country." Hoover, of course, was known, had made his fortune as an engineer. I'm going to name it Hoover Dam. That name stuck for about 3 years, or until the Roosevelt administration came in and Harold Ickes, FDR's Interior Secretary and a Republican who detested Hoover, took Hoover's name off the dam, renamed it Boulder Dam, and that there it stayed for 14 years or until the Republicans came back into the majority in Congress and they put Hoover's name back on. And Harry Truman, who was president at the time, thought the better part of valor was not getting involved in that fight. And ever since, we've known it as Hoover Dam.
Been Hoover Dam ever since. That's right. The thing probably most notable about that name of Herbert Hoover, other than the fact that he's still associated with the Depression, and this was built during the Depression. It's amazing to think that such a project of staggering ambition and proportion could be put up during those years.
Well, that's one of the things that makes it such a remarkable structure and a remarkable project. Interestingly enough, the project actually dated back many decades before then. As early as 1907, Theodore Roosevelt was talking about taming the Colorado River with a comprehensive program of dam building and reservoir building. This dam, the project had been approved by Congress in 1928. The bill to fund it had been signed by President Calvin Coolidge, but there were no plans to actually get it started in the early 30s because the entire federal construction budget at the time was $150 million a year. This was going to cost $165. But unemployment was getting so bad that Hoover accelerated the schedule and ordered the work started in 1930.
And we're talking about a project that, as you point out in your book, has come to be appropriately associated with America can-do spirit and all of that. I mean, especially during the time of the Depression. In fact, we had Kevin Starr on recently, and he said, well, it really led directly to the building of the Golden Gate Bridge.
It did. I would say it inaugurated an era of great public works. As I said, the federal government was not really in the business of building on the scale. The Panama Canal was decades and decades in the past. One of the reasons that the dam got started in 1930 was because when Hoover looked around for projects that could put men to work, this was the only one of any size that had already been approved by Congress, signed into law, and had been designed. It was the only shovel-ready project around, to use a term that we're now familiar with. So there wasn't much else there. And to his credit, he got it started and pushed it along.
And it made a new West. But as you say in your book, confined it in a straitjacket.
That's right.
Because to a great extent, it becomes a symbol of so much of the water fights that have gone on and water rights in the West and continues to, in some ways, really resonate on those scales.
That's right. When I say that the dam built the West and confined it in a straitjacket, the truth is that the dam was built on the basis of something of a fraud, and that is the expectation that the Colorado River, if it could be tamed and stored in a reservoir, would produce enough water for anything that any of the seven states in the basin could want to do, that there would be enough water there for almost unlimited irrigation, for industrial development, for the growth of cities. And from the beginning, it was clear to anyone who really looked at the figures that the Colorado does not produce enough water for all those needs. And we're now at the era of limits. We've now come face to face with the fact that we've developed in the West to an extent that can't be served by the Colorado.
Well, that gets us back to the compact of these seven states, because they were battling over water rights. And we're talking about California, Nevada, Wyoming, Colorado, New Mexico, Arizona, and Utah. And somehow, not only were they able to be brought together in this project, but so were a number of corporations. I mean, when you look back on it, it's pretty dramatic to bring all these divisive forces together.
Well, it was a superhuman task. These were seven states that had spent decades and decades squabbling over water rights on the Colorado, and in an atmosphere of mutual recrimination and mutual suspicion, all seven suspected each other of wanting to steal their rights to the water, and six of them all suspected California of wanting to steal all the water, which was probably not untrue.
We've all seen Chinatown, right?
Well, we've all seen Chinatown, and that's very much part of the story. In any event, before this dam could be built, Congress said that the basin states would have to resolve the legal issues about who had rights to the water, who had appropriation rights. So the seven states had to sit down. They had to negotiate a compact, which is essentially an interstate treaty. It's allowed in the Constitution. But to get those negotiations done, President Warren Harding put his Commerce Secretary, Herbert Hoover, into the negotiations as adult supervision. And Hoover supervised those negotiations, and he got the compact drafted. And it remains to this day a seminal document in American history, certainly in the history of the West.
Talking again with Pulitzer Prize-winning Michael Heltzik of the Los Angeles Times, who has written a new book, Colossus, Hoover Dam and the Making of the American Century, as he calls it, the physical embodiment of transformation and probably what ushered in the New Deal. But there's also that, I mean, it's an extraordinary story of public works and of getting this, well, dream in the eye of the beholder built. And I want to talk with you about some of those beholders, especially Frank Crowe. But there's a sense in the story that is really quite ugly. And I'm talking about the way labor was used and strikes were crushed and white-only hiring and the way people lived in these ragtag towns almost out of Steinbeck. As I said in my introduction, you know, deaths being essentially whitewashed. Sure. It's the Depression, but it's really depressing to read about.
Well, this is an era, first of all, where workplace safety was not really part of anybody's it was not on anybody's radar screen at the time. The contractors, six companies are the big six, which were dominated by Bechtel, Warren Bechtel, the founder of that company, and Henry Kaiser, who was his partner at the time. Their goal was to get the dam built and get it done as quickly as possible because they faced pretty stiff penalties if they missed deadlines. When they won the bid and signed the contract, the government contract essentially turned over all control over the workforce to them, the contractors. There were two restrictions in the contract about how they could use the workforce. One was they were barred from hiring Mongolians. That's in the contract, and that dates back.
That doesn't mean from Mongolia.
No, that was Asians. That was a term of art for Asians, particularly Chinese, and that was an artifact of the Chinese exclusion laws of the 1890s, and remained in federal contracts right into the 1940s. The other restriction was that the contractors were to give veterans returning from the Great War, the Philippine Insurrection, preference in hiring, and that was a requirement that the contractors regularly flouted. But there was no oversight from the government in terms of how the men were to be treated, how much they were going to be paid. The Davis-Bacon Act, which mandates that government projects pay the prevailing wage, which is to say the union wage, was signed a couple of weeks after the dam contract was signed, so it didn't apply. The contractors really had full latitude to run the men on the pace of the work, on the safety of the work, and they took full advantage of that.
Which gets us to Frank Crowe.
That's right. Frank Crowe was the superintendent. I write about six companies, this construction consortium, as an entity that was essentially designed to put Frank Crowe to work. Crowe was the leading dam building manager of his day. He built 14 dams across the West. He was an inventive, resourceful designer of logistics and engineering, and he was a commanding leader of men. But he was very firm. His interest was the same as his employers and the governments, which was to get the dam built as fast as possible. So he was not above firing men, taking advantage of the huge supply of labor that had gathered in and around Las Vegas and in and around the dam site to get the work done that he wanted. There were several.
But they come in 2 years before, didn't it?
Well, yes, he got the dam built 2 years ahead of schedule, which was an amazing achievement considering the landscape and the conditions.
Also, when you think about construction, it was only about 5.8 million above the budget by today's standards. You know, that would be beyond our ken or our possibility.
That's right. It may have been the first and last government program that came in so far ahead of schedule.
I think absolutely the first and the last. Talking again with Michael Hiltzik, his book is Colossus, and nobody died being buried in concrete. This was all urban legend stuff that many people still continue, I think, to bandy about when they talk about the history of the Hoover Dam, Boulder Dam. But the truth of the matter is there were a lot of deaths, well over 100, and some of them because of carbon monoxide that could have been avoided. Most of these deaths, in fact, all of them could have been avoided.
Well, that's right. There were about 100 that are officially recorded as construction deaths, men falling off the top of the dam, being run over by trucks. A lot of men died in premature dynamite blasts because they were untrained at dealing with dynamite and the fuses. But there were scores upon scores of men who are not recorded as construction fatalities or construction injuries. because of two aspects. One was in the first summer of construction, the work camp, which became Boulder City, Nevada, was not yet built, and the men who were working on the dam in this furnace of a gorge in the Colorado desert were also living in the gorge. Their bodies simply—
Excuse me, Michael. We're talking about temperatures like 130 degrees.
130 degrees, temperatures that would persist well into the evening. The canyon would just concentrate the heat of the sun. It was brutal. So there were a lot of deaths from heat prostration that were simply not recorded as construction deaths. And then later on, when the project got to the point where it was driving tunnels through solid rock to divert the Colorado, the contractors made the deliberate decision to use gasoline-fueled equipment underground, which was illegal in Nevada, but they held themselves exempt from those laws. And it was not the normal state of the technology in construction underground either. So scores of men died from carbon monoxide poisoning. They would be hauled out of the tunnels, one or two points, like cordwood, as one of the witnesses said. And then they would be trucked up to the Six Companies infirmary or to Las Vegas to the hospital, where the doctors there would diagnose them as having suffered or died from pneumonia. And they did that because pneumonia was not a compensatable injury, was not viewed as a construction injury, so their families didn't have to be paid, whereas carbon monoxide poisoning or gas poisoning was a compensatable injury, and that would have cost Six Companies a lot of money. But they saved about $300,000 by not having to have a separate fleet of dump trucks and shovels underground running on electricity.
And there were physicians, clearly, who conspired with them.
Well, these were physicians, for the most part, who worked for
the company.
For the company. On occasion, there would be a coroner's jury that would be impaneled by the state of Nevada, on occasion by the state of Arizona. In those cases, they would take testimony from witnesses, and the witnesses would typically be foremen working for Six Companies and Frank Crowe.
They could have used electric vehicles.
Well, they could have, and that was the standard at the time. Government projects elsewhere in the West were using electric vehicles. That would not have been a problem, except that it would have cost the contractors to bring them in.
In fact, I couldn't help thinking, you're probably old enough to remember Tennessee Ernie Ford's great hit, "I Owe My Soul to the Company Store," you know, 16 tons. I mean, Hooverville was like this ragtag place. I said I compared it to Steinbeck in my own head, but no clean water, no sanitation, hot as an oven or a furnace, as you said. It's pretty dreadful living.
That's right. It was the worst period was the first year of construction. Because Hoover had accelerated the project so much, work began in the canyon before there was a work camp. Work camp normally in a project like this, you build the camp first. There wasn't time for that. Now, Boulder City got built over the next year, and it's built high on a hill on a ridge about 8 miles from the river. It's much more comfortable. To this day, it's a very nice little sort of Midwestern small town. That was a much healthier place for the men and their families to live, but even once that was built under the Hoover administration, that was very much a company town. Six Companies owned the general store. They paid their men when they could in scrip that was redeemable at par only at the company store. The contractors really, even then, controlled the workforce.
A lot of avarice. These contractors, I think it would be an operative word, wouldn't it?
Sure. There was avarice. The company store was just one example. They also instituted a huge mess hall, which they subsidized from their own revenues from the government. But they were constantly squeezing the commissary operators to provide less food, to charge the men more, so that their subsidy didn't have to be so large. Then there was another aspect. Boulder City was built without schools. partially because the government wanted to save money, partially because they weren't thinking ahead. And six companies whose employees really were the parents, the fathers of hundreds upon hundreds of school children, refused to pay for schools or teachers until they got a tax break, essentially. So there was so much avarice that they were even holding school children hostage to their own profits.
A lot of battles I suppose one could think of today between conservatives and liberals over. In fact, this is really, when you think about it, stimulus funding in many respects. You talked about before the revenues from the government. So kind of a stimulus funding project.
Well, it was a stimulus funding project. And the man who really recognized the power of the symbol of the dam as economic stimulus was Franklin Roosevelt, who, of course, didn't have anything to do with getting the dam designed, built, or launched, but understood the moment he became president the power of the project as a symbol. And he took pains. This year is a 75th anniversary of this moment. He came out to dedicate the dam in September of 1935, and his goal was to appropriate this project, which by then was nationally famous, a monument to American know-how and enterprise. He came out to appropriate it for the New Deal. And on that day, he gave a speech. Harold Ickes gave a speech. There were festivities all day. And the name of Herbert Hoover was not mentioned even once.
Probably couldn't have been a New Deal had it not been for this dam. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's quite possible. The dam really did show the way to how you can use government spending to put men to work.
And we're talking about roughly, again, 21,000 men as the...
About 21,000 men over the entire construction period. Peak employment at any one time, this was about July 1934, was 5,200 men working on this project.
And the last, there's this ironic story about the last man on the job, so to speak.
Right. The last man and the first man.
The last first, man and the first man, yeah.
The first man to die in Boulder Canyon on this project a little bit before actual construction got started was a man named Tierney, who fell over from a survey barge into the river and was washed downstream. The last man to die on the project, who fell from one of the intake towers during the last stages of concreting, was a man named Tierney, and they were father and son. And they died on the same day of the year, about 17 or 18 years apart.
What a strange, synchronicity or something along those lines.
That's right, sort of morbid bookmarks to this great
project.
Yeah, morbid
bookmarks, a good way to describe it. We're talking again with Michael Hiltzik, veteran reporter and columnist for the Los Angeles Times. His book, which I personally compared to the McCulloch book on the Brooklyn Bridge. I think it is in that category, Hoover Dam and the Making of the American Century, a book anybody interested in history in this part of not only California history, but the history of the West and American history would, I think, be advised to read. He's here with us at a pre-recorded hour of Forum, and we're going to continue this discussion. Again, you're listening to Forum on KQED Public Radio, and I'm Michael Krasny. This is Michael Krasny, and you're listening to a pre-recorded hour of Forum. We're spending the hour with veteran Los Angeles Times reporter and columnist Michael Hiltzik, who is, among other things, a recipient of the Pulitzer Prize. His new book is called Colossus, Hoover Dam and the Making of the American Century. And we've been talking about to what extent this is really a story about the importance of the Colorado River and about hydroelectric power. It really, I mean, the other narrative thread here and the other important side of this epic story is that we're talking about what made possible the growth of the Southwest.
That's right. 45 million. The Southwest has grown in population by about 45 million people since 1930. And a lot of that growth really is the result of having built Hoover Dam and the dams that followed. But Hoover Dam, of course, was the first and certainly the most important. It provides water for irrigation, particularly in California and Arizona, water for a tremendous growth of industry in all those states, and water for the growth of the major metropolises of the region, certainly Los Angeles, but also San Diego, Phoenix, Salt Lake, Denver. All of these cities, in one way or another, really owe their development to the Colorado and to the harnessing of it by this dam.
Why the Art Deco?
Well, that was the artistic style and the architectural style. The architecture of the dam is something we owe to a man named Gordon Kaufman, who was he was British born. He was a very prominent architect in Southern California at the time the dam was being designed. Kaufman was brought in. It's not entirely clear who hired him, but it's interesting to note that at the same time he was putting the architectural finish on Hoover Dam, he was also designing the headquarters of the Los Angeles Times. So he was a protege of Harry Chandler, the proprietor of the Times, who at that point had become a huge booster of this dam. And in fact, the dam and the Times building have a lot of architectural resemblance. Now, Kaufman had become an adherent of what we might think of as machine age architecture. He liked simple lines that projected strength and also elegance, and you can see that in the dam. I think it's one of the features, one of the factors that makes it such a remarkable project and such an impressive structure. The original designers, who were government architects, had created this dam with all sorts of neoclassical gingerbread. The power station looked; it had all sorts of columns and windows. It looked like the facade of a New England mill. It had columns and eagles perched on top of the on top of the crest. Well, Kaufman came in and he stripped all that away. His principle was that it just interfered with the power of the structure, and he wanted that to be the thing that impressed people when they came to see it. And he was right. It's the architectural quality of the structure is something. It's a byword, I think, in civil engineering, and it's Gordon Kaufman's work.
Well, you say, in fact, it's a landmark of architecture and of engineering both.
That's right. It's a beautiful structure. There's really nothing like it. It's the ideal melding of form and function, which is a concept that hadn't
Frank
quite
Lloyd
gotten
Wright.
to this country yet. But yes, it's
largely Frank Lloyd Wright. Yeah, right. But you also, getting back to the Colorado River, talk about how it diminished flooding, but then talk a bit about the concern that many have had with this dam about the river's ecology.
Sure. The United States has sort of gotten out of the business of building great dams because we've come to understand that there are compromises that you have to make when you build a dam. Not only are they hugely expensive in capital terms, but they do wreak havoc on the upstream and the downstream ecology. I think scientists have determined that there are at least 8 species of fish that are probably wiped out. Or were wiped out when the dam was built. There's certainly changes in water quality downstream. There are biological habitats that have been destroyed, some of which, we don't even know what was destroyed because there were no studies done. There was no environmental impact statement done at the time. There were no cultural impact statements done at the time. There was one Native American settlement that had been buried that was rescued, at least archaeologically rescued, by the efforts of one single man. But that was something that was not regarded as very important at the time. Because of Hoover Dam, and there are now 6 or 7 dams downstream of Hoover, what's left of the Colorado when it reaches its natural outflow into the Gulf of California is barely a trickle, and it's a very brackish trickle to boot. This is a river that is probably the most heavily exploited in North America, and there's a lot that we pay for that to have happened.
Again, we're talking with Michael Heltzik. His new book is Colossus, Hoover Dam and the Making of the American Century. You know, you were talking before about going back historically to Warren Harding, but when you begin your book, you're actually talking about Franklin Pierce's administration, and you get into the reclamation of the desert and the journey of death and all that. I mean, this history and this vision does extend back into our national history.
Right. Well, you can take the history back as far as the conquistadors who first discovered the Colorado. I mean, they were the first Europeans to discover the Colorado. The Colorado came in, swam into the national consciousness, really, with the 49ers. The discovery of gold created a huge wave of immigration from the Southeast and the Northeast and the Midwest. All those 49ers, or Argonauts, as they were known at the time, had to cross the Colorado. Many of them, when they crossed the Colorado, they were attacked by Native American tribes. And the U.S. government, basically through that process, discovered that it had this major river out there that it had to keep an eye on. So after the 49ers, there were a lot of explorations that were designed to see how far upstream the Colorado was navigable, because the U.S. Army had created a string of forts and garrisons across the West, and they wanted to provision them not over land, which would take weeks. So they started exploring the Colorado. They rediscovered the Grand Canyon in that process, and the man who rediscovered the Grand Canyon for the U.S. government, an explorer with the great name of Joseph Christmas Ives, also discovered Black Canyon and, in fact, almost wrecked his boat as he was entering Black Canyon. That's the site that later became the dam site. But this was the process that really started the era of discovery, and it also led to the discovery that the Colorado Desert, that is the desert that runs from the river west to the site of present-day San Diego, was not really a desert. It was potentially a Garden of Eden for agricultural farmers if they could only irrigate it. So they began irrigating it from the Colorado River.
And you mentioned the names early on of Jefferson Davis and Audubon.
That's right. Well, Audubon's son was one of the 49ers, or he was one of the explorers who came along with the 49ers. Jefferson Davis instituted, when he was Franklin Pierce's Secretary of War, he instituted what was known as the Great Reconnaissance, a huge period of exploration of that part of the country. And that's the process that led to the recognition that there was money to be made in the Southwest.
Once the dam went under construction, and even before that, the private utilities companies began to fight and combat it. You know. Let's talk about that.
Sure. Well, in the 20s, you saw the rise of the concept of public power. In 1924, I believe the date was, the city of Los Angeles who condemned the electrical grid of the Edison Company and created what is to this day the largest municipal power agency in the country. Today, the Division of Water and Power. The private utility companies were enormously powerful at that time. You can compare them, I think, to Wall Street today. They really dominated investment and industry and commerce in the United States. And, of course, they wanted no part of public power, and they fought it vehemently and viciously and quite underhandedly. They would go out and finance political campaigns for ordinances that barred political power. This is something that we still see them doing in California, of course. And when the Boulder Canyon project was first proposed, they understood that if this dam generated power, it would be a benchmark against which their private rates would be measured, and they certainly didn't want any part of that. Now, one of their colleagues in this fight was Herbert Hoover, who, as a matter of principle, didn't think that, that government should do anything that private enterprise could do, and that included generating electricity. So one of the ironies of the story is that Hoover Dam is a dam that Herbert Hoover did not actually want built. He wanted a much smaller dam, much lower, that would provide irrigation water and flood control and leave it at that.
Which was also part of the reason why there was so much dispute over whether his name should grace it, right?
Well, that's right. When Ray Lyman Wilbur put Hoover's name on the dam, yes, the people who had really been instrumental in pushing the project along, including Hiram Johnson, great California progressive politician who was then one of California's senators, really resented it because they knew how hard they had had to fight with Hoover to get the dam that they wanted approved and built in the canyon. And Hiram Johnson and Herbert Hoover had spent a lot of the 20s fighting with each other for the presidential nomination. So Johnson didn't have much use for Hoover, but he particularly resented that act.
We talked about how the compact of the seven states came to be. What about the consortium? How did that take place?
Well, that was a very interesting process. Normally, when the government paid for large projects that required a lot of different construction skills, it would divide up the job and it would hand out contracts individually. The Department of the Interior understood that this was going to be such a big project that that process wouldn't work. If one subcontractor got something wrong, there would be too much at stake. So it required coordination. And the way the government went about that was by making it one single contract, an enormous contract. It was going to be at least $50 million just for the dam and reservoir itself. And there was no construction company in the country that could really handle that by itself, no company that could raise the money for the construction bond that would be necessary. So inevitably, that required a number of contractors to get together. To a certain extent, the consortium was put together by financiers in San Francisco who were going to issue the bond. They wanted everybody on board, but Bechtel, Kaiser, a company called Utah Construction, which no longer exists, was a major participant, and eight companies came together, various partnerships. They became six, and six companies at the time was the name for a Chinese consortium here in San Francisco that kept peace in Chinatown, and it was meaningful to the San Franciscan contractors, and they said, let's name it after them.
Talking again with Michael Hiltzik, and his new book is Colossus, Hoover Dam, and the Making of the American Century. Just to realize the scope and the size of this, I think you come up with a figure in your book that there were 3.25 million cubic yards of concrete that went into the building of this dam.
That's right. That was as much concrete that had been poured on all the dams built in the United States, all the concrete dams up to that point. The dam, Hoover Dam, was twice the height of any other dam that had ever been built. It was in an especially inhospitable location. And the way I put it in the book is that this is a dam that had to be invented as it rose from the bedrock.
Kind of invented it as they went along.
They did invent it as they went along. They had to invent new equipment. They had to invent new construction techniques. They had to invent new formulations of concrete because mass concrete had never been poured to undergo the stresses and strains that this dam was going to face. So the government created two government laboratories, the first ones that we've had in our history, to develop these new formulations.
What would you advise? I mean, millions of people go to see Hoover Dam every year. It's one of the biggest tourist attractions in the country. Just in terms of some of the things that people should observe or that they should look for that maybe – I mean, because it's a breathtaking thing to see, but that they might not see, say, on first observational or spectatorial view.
Well, the dam commands attention in many ways. When you drive down around a cliffside and it's there open before you, it's a remarkable sight. There's a lot about the dam that unfortunately people don't get to see anymore. Progressive concerns about security. They're beautiful. There's beautiful terrazzo in the galleries inside that I think tourists aren't allowed to see. But it's important to look at certainly the architecture and the play of light and shadow at all times of the day on this dam. The strength of it, the width of it at the bottom, the dam is over-engineered. In fact, it's probably three times as thick as it needs to be, but there were concerns about dams breaking. I think it's important to look at Lake Mead and see what I call the bathtub ring. Lake Mead is about 100 feet below its maximum level right now. This is a consequence of the drought. You can see it on this line of white all the way around the reservoir. And I think that tells us both the power, the bounty that the dam produces, but also the limitations.
It's almost a metaphor in some ways, isn't it, about what man can do and can't do?
Well, it's a living, breathing metaphor. It's almost more than a metaphor. It's reality. We know that the dam on occasion has not even succeeded in stemming floods downstream. There was a huge flood in 1983, exactly the sort of thing the dam was designed to forestall. But that happened because the men who ran the dam and the other dams on the Colorado system weren't missed the signs that there was going to be a huge flow of water coming from the melting snowpack. And that was devastating because people didn't expect it. So yeah, I think we need to – when we look at Hoover Dam, we need to respect its power and its capability and also its limitations.
And also you can't help respecting and reading your book just the ordinary laborers who came and put in the toil and really are responsible so much for all of the onerousness of what went into building that dam. Where did the workers come from for the most part?
Well, they came from almost every state. The first laborers, the core of the workforce, were miners. That was their skill because more than half of the work on the dam was excavation and driving tunnels through rock. So those skills were important, but it was an extremely varied workforce. There were former bank presidents, executives who were out of work. There were miners. There were laborers. There were farmers and settlers whose farms had been destroyed, miners who had been put out of work. They came from all over. And they gathered in Las Vegas, which was then a dusty little railroad depot that was actually on the verge of being shut down by the Union Pacific. And they bedded out on the lawn in front of City Hall, just waiting for work. So it was just a huge workforce. This was one of the only known sources of employment in the country when it started. In fact, government officials had put out the word in newspapers nationwide to say, don't come here unless you already have a job or you have the money to live on before you can get a job, because there's not going to be enough work for everybody if every unemployed person comes to Nevada.
Strikes were crushed.
The major strike that occurred was in that first summer of 1931. The Wobblies, the Industrial Workers of the World, which was a moribund union at that point, it had basically been destroyed by government lawsuits and arrests. But what was left of the Wobblies saw the Boulder Canyon project as a real opportunity to revive itself. So they came out and they started organizing, and six companies, the contractors, played into their hands. Toward the end of this killing summer, when men were dying from heat stroke, six companies one day announced that they were going to cut everybody's wages from a maximum of about $5.50 a day to $5 or $4.50 a day. This was the Wobblies' chance. They organized the men. The men walked off, and the government basically colluded with the contractors to break that strike. They evicted everybody from the work camps. They put a fence around the construction site, and they halted work, which, of course, brought brought back in sharp relief what was out there in the world if you didn't have a job on this dam. And the strike basically collapsed in about a week.
Talking again with Michael Hiltzik, and his new book is Colossus. Dan Zoll, our senior editor producer, reminds me that we see Hoover Dam in many films, including Ocean's 11, Diamonds Are Forever, Superman. What do you think about the portrayal in the silver screen of Hoover Dam?
Well, it is. I think it's a symbol of the iconic power of this. Alfred Hitchcock used Hoover Dam in his movie Saboteur. Transformers, you know, a modern day blockbuster, used it as a plot point. Stating that I think the theme there is that Hoover Dam was built to house a giant pulsing purple cube that aliens had come to deposit here on Earth. And I looked for that cube and couldn't find it when I was researching that book. So
maybe they're keeping it hidden like
somewhere. Yeah, I don't think that movie's really historically accurate. But yeah, novelists have used it to launch their plots. Movie makers are always there. While the dam was being built, Warner Brothers came out and started filming a movie in which the construction of the dam was going to be the backdrop to basically a melodrama. And that movie came out, I think it was called Boulder Dam. Frank Capra came out to scout the location, though he never actually made a movie. But you see it all the time, over and over again. You see it in television commercials. I think AT&T, just within the last few months, had a commercial in which they wrapped it in fabric. So that just tells you, how notable it is as an icon of American history and American technology.
And because of that iconic status, there remains concerns about terrorism with the Hoover Dam.
Well, that's right. And that's why it's so unfortunate that tourists today get to see a movie. They get a tour. I believe they're brought down to a gallery that overlooks the turbines, which are remarkable structures in themselves. In earlier years, you could actually go down much further into the dam. The dam is shot through with service galleries, and in fact, there's at least one or two tourist galleries that were designed into it. And these were decorated with a theme from the Indian Southwest, beautiful terrazzo tiling by an artist named Alan Tupper True, whose most notable surviving image is the cowboy on a bronco that to this day is part of the state of Wyoming's license plates. But he was a notable artist at the time.
No, and their license plates. I think it's on all their road signs.
Yes, I think it is. It's
people used to go shoot at it. In fact, you can see, see the bullet holes in there.
Yeah, so it's beautiful inside and out. I'm told the last time I was there, the supervisors told me that there are plans to expand the tour inside. But they are concerned. In fact, one of the terrorism security concerns are one of the is one rationale for the construction of a new bridge just downstream from Hoover Dam that spans the Colorado. Another enormous project associated with Hoover Dam, beautiful bridge so you can now drive from Nevada to Arizona up there without having to cross over the crest of the dam, which was a traffic bottleneck anyway, but also clearly a security concern.
Well, only a little time left here, unfortunately, and this may be in the realm of speculative and hypothetical, but could it be built today, do you think?
You know, that's a very good question, and it's a question that I try to address in the book. It's a very hard question to answer because the world that we're asking about is in so many ways the product of Hoover Dam. The impetus to build Hoover Dam came from Western politicians who were feeling their oats. This was the surging West in political terms. It was getting a critical mass politically and economically that, of course, it's built on since then. But clearly there would be a lot of legal and bureaucratic obstacles to building a dam on this scale today. The environmental impact statement alone would take years upon years to complete. cultural artifacts that today lie beneath Lake Mead, Indian settlements. There's a Mormon settlement that was inundated by the dam. That would be a concern. The cost of the dam would be many, many billions of dollars today. And the question is to whether the water that's provided by the dam would be worth that investment. That would be a question we would have to ask today, and we ask it now. Reservoir water, when you build a big dam, that's very expensive water. In this region, we're on the hunt for much cheaper water or more efficient ways of using what we have. And that would all play into this decision. It would take decades. It did take decades then, after all, and it would take decades, possibly many more decades today.
Michael Heltzik's book, Colossus, Hoover Dam and the Making of the American Century. It's been delightful to have you. Thank you so much.
It's been my pleasure.
And we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. This has been a special pre-recorded edition of Forum. We remind you that we like to hear from you, and if you'd like to let us know about what you think about what you hear on Forum or make suggestions, certainly do that by email, forum@kqed.org, or call our listener call-in response line at 415-553-3300. Our thanks to our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and to our producers, Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell. Our engineer today is Howard Gelman, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. And for all of us at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.